Today is Tuesday, March 23rd, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, COVID-19 cases rising again in the U.S.
We are at a critical point in this pandemic, a fork in the road where we as a country must decide which path we are going to take.
Also, European Union imposes sanctions on Chinese and Myanmar officials.
Rather than change its policies and address our legitimate concerns, China has again turned a blind eye.
Plus, 10 million children are out of school in Nigeria. These stories and more are next. New cases of COVID-19 infections in the United States rose 5% to more than 394,000 last week, the first increase after declining for 9 straight weeks, according to Reuters' analysis of state, county, and CDC data. Governor Garay reports.
New cases of COVID-19 are up again in a majority of U.S. states. That's according to a Reuters analysis that found COVID cases in the United States rose 5% to more than 394,000 last week. It's the first increase after declining numbers for 9 weeks straight. 30 out of 50 states reported more new infections in the week ending March 21st compared with the previous 7 days, up from 19 states the prior week. The CDC's Dr. Rochelle Walensky has warned that infections could surge again if Americans relaxed social distancing restrictions too quickly, with more infectious variants spreading across the country.
Believe me, I get it. We all want to return to our everyday activities and spend time with our family, friends, and loved ones. But we must find the fortitude to hang in there for just a little bit longer. And I am worried that if we don't take the right actions now, we will have another avoidable surge, just as we are seeing in Europe right now.
The Northeast logged some of the highest rates of infection per capita, led by New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island. Deaths from COVID, however, fell 15% by about 1,100 per day. So too did the average number of COVID patients in hospitals, which was down by 6%, the lowest since October. Health officials hope the country's vaccination effort can prevent a rise in deaths, even if cases surge again.
That's Governor Garay of Reuters. As COVID-19 cases continue to rise, members of the White House COVID response team warned Americans against travel, citing new and contagious variants of the virus. Director, U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Rochelle Walensky.
I get it. We all want to return to our everyday activities and spend time with our family, friends, and loved ones. But we must find the fortitude to hang in there for just a little bit longer. We are at a critical point in this pandemic, a fork in the road, where we as a country must decide which path we are going to take. We must act now, and I am worried that if we don't take the right actions now, we will have another avoidable surge, just as we are seeing in Europe right now, and just as we are so aggressively scaling up vaccination.
That's Director, U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Rochelle Walensky. A shooting at a crowded supermarket in the U.S. state of Colorado Monday leaves 10 dead, including a police officer, and sent terrorized shoppers and workers scrambling for safety. AP correspondent Judy Walker reports.
Police have the gunman in custody. They walked him out of the store shirtless, blood dripping down his leg, after he opened fire outside and inside the King Super grocery store in Boulder, where Nevin Sloan was shopping with his wife and spoke with KMGH.
It's like bang, 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 and I immediately sprinted over to her and was like, hey, we got to get out of here.
Boulder Police Chief Maris Harold was heartbroken over another mass shooting in a state that has seen its share over the years.
My heart goes out to the victims.
One was the first officer to arrive on the scene.
And I am so sorry about the loss of Officer Tally.
Police won't speculate on a motive. This was the 7th mass killing in the U.S. this year. I'm Julie Walker.
The European Union imposed sanctions on Monday on 4 Chinese officials, including a top security director for human rights abuses, Ng Seng Yang, to which Beijing responded with its own sanctions on Europeans. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. That's EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell.
This package includes 4 individuals and 1 entity from China, who have had an active role in the design and implementation of the Chinese policies in Xinjiang. We were made aware during the meeting that China has retaliated to those sanctions and rather than change its policies and address our legitimate concerns, China has again turned a blind eye, and these measures are regrettable, unacceptable.
Also, the EU is hitting Myanmar military officials with sanctions following a seizure of power. AP correspondent Charles de Ladesma reports.
The bloc's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, says the EU is penalising the officials accused of being involved in a military coup and the violent crackdown on protesters that followed.
We are going to take sanctions against 11 persons involved in the coup and on the repression of the demonstrators.
The military junta had prevented Myanmar's parliament from convening on February 1 and claimed that last November's elections, won by the pro-democracy party in a landslide, were tainted by fraud. In the face of persistent strikes and protests, the junta has responded with an increasingly violent crackdown and efforts to limit the information reaching the outside world. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The UN Refugee Agency warns that humanitarian crisis in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province is evolving rapidly and could negatively impact the surrounding region if it is not addressed. Two senior officials have just returned from a visit to the area. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The officials visited makeshift settlements for displaced people in Cabo Delgado. They say the insurgency, which began 4.5 years ago, is escalating rapidly and forcing increasing numbers of people to flee their homes. They report 90% of the displaced are living with family and friends in urban areas where they receive support. About 10%, they say, are unable to find refuge and are living under appalling conditions. UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Triggs, says their shelters are of the most primitive kind. She says the government last distributed food to them in December. Consequently, she says people are scrounging for roots and leaves and fields to feed themselves and their families. She says she heard shocking stories from grandmothers who were caring for orphan children.
And in this case, a grandmother was caring for a baby a few months old. Her daughter had been killed in the conflict. The father of the child had been killed and beheaded. And the mother was now, or the grandmother rather, was now in this period of grief trying to care for this child without milk, where they were grinding up root vegetables for the children, giving them diarrhea and exposing them to all sorts of other things.
Trigg says the displaced in Cabo Delgado need everything: shelter, food, clothing, medical care, and protection from violence. She says there's no electricity in the makeshift settlements, and women are terrified of going out at night. More than 2,000 people have been killed since the start of the insurgency in October 2017. Triggs notes there has been a significant increase in violence in the past year.
In terms of what's actually been happening, villages have been set on fire, people killed, beheaded, including children, or reports of children being beheaded, rape, and, of course, huge levels of sexual violence of one kind or another. So those are the, I mean, this is a full insurgency, a conflict of a very serious kind.
The insurgency is led by militants who affiliated themselves with the Islamic State group in 2019. The UNHCR warns the current number of 700,000 internally displaced people is expected to rise to 1 million by June if this increasingly brutal conflict continues to be overlooked by the international community. The agency reports last November's $254 million appeal has received just 5%, a sum far too low to make a dent in providing the most basic of needs for people struggling to survive. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Ethiopia's leader says atrocities have occurred in Tigray, the country's northern region, where fighting persists as government troops hunt down its fugitive leaders. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said in an address before lawmakers in the capital Addis Ababa Tuesday that reports indicate that atrocities have been committed in Tigray. This is the first time Abir appears to acknowledge that serious crimes have been perpetrated in Tigray, home to 6 million people. Facebook has allowed groups, many tied to QAnon and militia movements, to glorify violence during the 2020 election, a new report finds. Avas, a group that says it seeks to protect democracies from misinformation, identified 267 pages and groups that spread violence glorifying material to a combined following of 32 million users. Despite what the group called clear violations of Facebook policies, 119 of the pages and groups are still active. Tensions are mounting between Afghanistan's government and a powerful local warlord. The warlord Abdul Ghani Alipour has deep support among ethnic Hazaras, a minority who sees him as a protector in the face of militant attacks and government corruption.
This is Science in a Minute.
I recently shared the sounds of Mars captured by NASA's Perseverance rover a day or so after its February 18th touchdown on the Red Planet. The space agency is sending the rover on short trips across the surface of Mars. Controllers on Earth switched on Perseverance's sensitive onboard microphone to capture the sounds as the rover rolled over the surface of Mars on a recent 27.3-meter-long trip. This is Perseverance on the move on Mars. Vandy Verma, the rover driver at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, says that people don't realize that the rover's wheels are actually made of metal. And when driving across Mars with these wheels, it's actually very noisy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. As Israelis vote today, opinion polls showed an uptick for Likud in the campaign's home stretch, giving a Netanyahu-led coalition of conservative and ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties around 60 seats, still short of a majority in a 120-member parliament. But the surveys indicated also that a potential, though perhaps unlikely, alliance of left-wing center and rightist factions, possibly led by Netanyahu's strongest rival in the polls, centralist Yair Lapid of the Yesh Atid party, is also near 60. No one party has ever won a parliamentary majority on its own in an Israeli election. Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, discussed with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawi the prospects of success for Netanyahu and his impact on the resumption of Palestinian-Israeli talks.
Usually what happens, and we've seen it in past rounds of Israeli elections, is that Netanyahu's Likud party actually gets higher numbers in the actual election than it did in the polls preceding the elections. So that's one thing that could happen. But what we've also seen in past election rounds is that the real game and what really ends up determining the makeup of the coalition and the government is not so much the results of the elections per se, but the results of the horse trading that comes after the elections when the heads of the parties start negotiating over the makeup of the coalition. And it seems at the moment that even if Netanyahu does not reach the 61 count that matters within his right-wing ultra-Orthodox bloc, he will most probably be able to sway some votes from the opposition to join his coalition and build a 61-plus governing coalition.
Despite corruption charges, he denied weekly street protests over his alleged graft and a trial scheduled to gain speed after the ballot, Netanyahu has managed to stay at Israel's helm. How do you explain that?
There are several ways to explain it. One good explanation is that Netanyahu is very successful at cutting down his opposition, whether it's opposition from within his party or opposition from competing parties. So that's he's very capable at that. He's a very shrewd politician. The second thing is that he has been somewhat successful in some of his policies, whether it's his ability to, you know, bring vaccines to Israel or diplomatic things like the Abraham Accords, the normalization with Arab countries and so so on. But I think that first and foremost, it's the fact that the Israeli electorate has now been conditioned to viewing him as the only person who has the qualifications to lead the country where the premiership is so complicated. He's just viewed as someone who does not have any real viable contenders. And therefore, what you see when people are asked in public opinion polls, who do you see as the most qualified to serve as prime minister? He has been leading with plurality, not a majority, but a plurality of somewhere between 35 and 40%, or sometimes even more than 40% for many, many years now. And it just shows how the Israeli public has been sort of conditioned to viewing him as being synonymous with the premiership in Israel.
That's Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Elshinawi. Analysts say the world's dependence on gasoline isn't likely to return to pre-pandemic levels as moves step up to increase fuel efficiency and the global shift accelerates to use alternative green energy sources, including electric vehicles. Despite the Biden administration's talks of recalibrating its relationship with Saudi Arabia over human rights concerns, analysts say Washington ties to the oil giant remain vital. For VOA, Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
The International Energy Agency, a Paris-based intergovernmental watchdog, says that while oil demand may continue to rise as developing countries with growing populations use more of it, such demand will be offset globally by an accelerating use of greener energy sources. Swiss energy analyst Cornelia Meyer says oil demand overall fell by close to 10% in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic. The world's largest oil company, Saudi Aramco, saw its profits nearly halved last year to $49 billion as the pandemic roiled global energy markets. But oil prices are edging up again as movement restrictions ease, commerce increases, and more people get vaccinated against COVID-19. President Biden, meanwhile, has waived punishment for Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the 2018 killing of U.S.-based Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, saying this would have been diplomatically unprecedented for the United States. This despite the unease it causes to U.S. strategic interests and values, says Princeton University Gulf scholar Bernard Heichel.
Saudi Arabia is an extremely important country for U.S. strategic interests. And it's not just about oil. It's also about the stability of the region. It has to do with global financial markets and their stability and the reserve currency, the dollar, being the principal currency in which oil is traded. So it's a very complicated relationship. The Biden administration cannot push purely human rights agenda when it comes to Saudi Arabia.
The U.S. also runs 5 military bases in Saudi Arabia and is eyeing expanding its operations there amid heightened tensions with Iran, which Yasmin Farouk, a visiting fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says is vital for Washington. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
From being Africa's newest female president to holding the second highest office in America to leading the World Trade Organization, black women are breaking barriers in several fields. Mariama Diallo reports on recent and past history-making moments as the world celebrates women's achievements in March.
It's been a history-making year for black women. Tanzania's Vice President Samia Suluhu Hassan became the country's first female president on March 19th, according to the Constitution, after the untimely death of its leader, John Magufuli, whose second term was to end in 2025. Some residents say they are optimistic.
I feel so happy that we have a female president right now. She will help us support and empower us in some of our businesses, especially business owners, so that we can grow.
In recent years, other African women have climbed to top positions. Mohamed Saliou Camara.
As of now, Africa has had 22 women heads of state or heads of government, meaning presidents or prime ministers, whether it's interim or acting or fully elected, and coming from 15 African countries.
This includes Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Malawi's Joyce Banda, Ethiopia's Sahle Work Zewde, the Central African Republic's Catherine Samba-Panza, among others. Senegal has had two female prime ministers, and other African countries have had female vice presidents, including Gambia, Zambia, and Tanzania. Also making history in 2021, economist and former Nigerian government minister Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala.
I'm very proud to be the first African.
On March 1st, she became the first woman and the first African to hold the position of Director General at the World Trade Organization. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Nigeria's Minister of Education has said the number of out-of-school children stands at 10.1 million, an increase of more than 3 million from last year. While no reasons were given for the increase announced Friday, experts point at the coronavirus pandemic and insecurities around schools. Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Abuja resident Florence Ulo is reviewing her five-year-old son's schoolwork at home and preparing him for an upcoming term examination. When COVID-19 hit last year, Ulo, like many Nigerian parents, withdrew her child from school over fear of exposing him to the coronavirus. Even after the reopening of schools, she says she decided that he'll remain at home for some months.
You know, when the COVID thing is started, once you contact the virus, they'll take you away. So the thought of being away from my child and being in another place and I can't have access to him was quite frightening. So I couldn't just take the risk. We had to stay back for a while.
Ulo's son recently returned to class after she said the school's precautionary measures to keep pupils safe had improved. But now, with many months out of school, he's trying to catch up.
I would go to the school and see their COVID-19 compliance level and all of that. And when I was satisfied to an extent, not like I was very comfortable about the whole thing, left for me, I wouldn't let my child go anywhere.
Nigeria's education ministry last Friday said the country has seen a jump of 3 million students out of school compared to a year ago. Even though authorities did not give reasons for the increase, the COVID-19 pandemic clearly was a factor. The Nigerian Union of Teachers, NUT, says recent attacks on schools in parts of northern Nigeria is also to blame for the increase. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison on Tuesday acknowledged mounting dissatisfaction with his handling of a series of allegations about the mistreatment of women in politics as he vowed to drive cultural change. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison faced mounting rage on Tuesday over his government's response to reports of mistreatment of women in politics. New allegations broke that male government staff had filmed themselves performing solo sex acts within Parliament, including on the desk of a female lawmaker. That was reported by newspaper The Australian as well as Channel 10. It follows a series of reported sexual assault incidents, including rape allegations against Attorney General Christian Porter, which he strongly denies. On Tuesday, Morrison vowed to drive cultural change and described the reports of the lewd acts as disgusting.
I'm shocked and I'm disgusted. It is shameful. It is just absolutely shameful. I was completely stunned, as I have been on more than one occasion over the course of this last month.
Morrison said he would speak to all government staff and remind them of their responsibilities, but didn't go so far as to say what action would be taken. However, he did say changes would arrive in the coming weeks.
Enough is enough.
The ruling party has faced a wave of sustained public pressure that spurred in part by tens of thousands of people rallying last week calling for justice for victims of sexual assault and an end to the degrading treatment of women in the workplace from sexual harassment to misogyny.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.